Okay, so this is the 25th of August for the benefit of the podcast. This is the Privacy in the Digital Age class. And you should all imagine that the slides you see on the screen all say 2011, because they do on my computer back at my house. See, done at the bottom. And that the examples that I have are updated, and I'll probably just go with web browsers, and I will up what will go on the TWEN page will be the correct updated version of the slides. Yeah, that's not true. Good news and bad news. Well, no, hopefully it's not bad news. Good news and other good news. Before I tell you that, Jamel Brown. Hello, Jamel. Thomas DeMarco? Tom or Thomas? What's Beth? Okay. Drone? Is Leon's on? Drone's not here? Okay. Krista, help me out here. Piscato? Hello, Krista. Francis Rabias? Rabias, I apologize. Joel Simon? Okay. Rosanna Vargas? No. Anybody here whose name is not on my... Yes. Okay. Did you not? Are you checking it out?
I added the class.
Okay. I guess this was printed before that. And
Dominic Lonzo.
Last name, Mr. Dominic.
Lonzo. L-A-N-Z-I.
Okay. I have a Dominic. So Avit and Dominic. Okay. Great. Thank you. I appreciate it. Tells you how useless this little blue piece of paper is. All right. That done. And I'm going to want to find out a little bit more about you folks as we get on, because this is a practical course. There, we will certainly discuss theory and ideas and concepts. But I come at this as someone who has been practicing business technology law for close to 20 years, who is in the midst of writing about it, but from a business perspective, from a real-world perspective. And the examples we're going to talk about, the law we're going to talk about, the practical stuff we're going to talk about, is very much grounded. So, good news and hopefully still good news. You notice, I think, that there were no books. Did you notice that?
We did.
The extra 100, how much did they cost these days, case books? Whatever it is, the extra... lots of money that you didn't have to spend. Trees, well, we'll see about the trees. The reason for that is twofold. One, there's a stellar casebook. I'm not criticizing it in the slightest, that I used 2 years ago, which was Information Privacy Law, 3rd edition. Maybe by now it's 4th edition. Great book. This thick. Very much into theory. When last I taught this course 2 years ago, we did a lot of skimming. And I felt guilty. Not because, you know, but because I said, it was the only book out there. So, I'm writing one. So that's the good news and the good news, right? The good news for me. The good news is you didn't have to buy a case book. You're welcome to, it's there, great book. But I am working on a course book in digital privacy law and data protection law. It is in process. So in case you were wondering why I was setting up a giant little wheel, you know, and some shavings on the floor, you're all my guinea pigs. And you're also my reality checks. I've got to get it done by the end of, really the end of the semester. So you will be receiving drafts of chapters. They will be somewhat incomplete. See a lot of, you know, here there be dragons or something. We're going to be adding stuff. I'm looking for feedback as well as looking to inform you. So it will be posted as it's completed to the TWEN site, which does in fact exist as of today. Please sign up for it. There will be a section on readings. The syllabus has a lot of to be announced because, A, I'm still working on it, and B, this is an insanely rapidly changing field. There are few areas of law. Is that black mark? Did I underline that?
watch out, because you can end up saying really embarrassing things that just that line turns into drawings for.
This is an area of law that is changing literally by the day. By the day, which is why I wanted to show you some real-world examples. Stop that. So, let me just show you. Yes, that's what I want to see. So, we say, yesterday, Facebook, actually, now the article's from today. It's a pretty big deal. Facebook, for the, 76th time, has changed its privacy settings. The biggest change, it says, Facebook made this week was a long-awaited overhaul to its deplorably and legally criticized complex privacy settings. From now on, users have much more granular control over what they share with whom when they update their statuses, because you can choose how private to make each and every update. Nice. That's story from probably a few hours ago. That's how quickly this is changing. Now you say, that's a company. That's not necessarily law, but it is. Because a lot of this law has to do with not so much statute. No. See? Privacy right there. A lot of this is not about statute, but it's about disclosure. It's about what you say or your clients say versus what they do. Facebook, its privacy settings, its privacy policy, what law applies to that? We'll get into this question, but I'm just wondering, what law applies to Facebook's privacy settings right now? You guys are certainly not first years anymore, right? Nobody's a brand new student, because you don't have 2 credits to spare. What law applies to Facebook's privacy settings? What does? Actually, probably not. Libel is probably not. Because there's a statute that expressly immunizes service providers from defamation cases about things that other people post. 47 U.S.C. 230. Very important. Not really for this class so much. Big in cyber law. So, I don't know. So what law applies? Why does Facebook do it at all? Remember what this article just said a minute and a half ago? What did the article say? It said, can you read this? No, because there's a line in the middle of the screen. The biggest change Facebook made this week was a long-awaited overhaul to its deplorably and legally criticized complex privacy set. Well, what does that tell us? There's a legal issue here. What's the legal issue? Let's click on the link. Out. The link is Facebook's privacy flap. Okay? So this is from my birthday 2 years ago. Okay? The decision followed because they were changing their terms of use. So this was not the privacy policy. The writer's being sloppy. But it's a relevant thing. Facebook 2 years ago made a change to its terms of use that gave Facebook a perpetual license to use materials posted on the site in lots of other forums, and they were criticized. By whom or what? Facebook's backtracking announcement, here's where we start finding our answer, came just hours after word broke that the Electronic Privacy Information Center, okay, so privacy, right, that's why we're here, an advocacy group based in Washington, intended to file a formal complaint with the Federal Trade Commission over the altered licenses. Federal Trade Commission? Why the Federal Trade Commission? Turns out, very important. Anyone have FTC experience in your real world lives? What does the FTC do? What's its mission? You've heard of it, I assume. I have to call people, really? This early on, I have to actually make name, you know, start throwing darts. Yes, sir.
Consumer protection.
Consumer protection. Very broad mandate. You will be at least skimming the FTC Act, but that's absolutely right. Okay. Consumer protection begins to give an answer to the question, what law applies? The law that says consumers must be protected or else. May not be abused or else. And what is the or else? The FTC comes a-calling. The FTC comes a-calling and comes a-fining because it has the power to protect consumers from misleading practices by business people. Back to our question about the privacy policy. What is a privacy policy? What's a privacy policy?
Where they're going to protect your personal information from being hacked to the outside world, theoretically.
Theoretically, but does it necessarily mean that that whomever publishes the policy is going to protect that information? What function does a privacy policy serve? Disclosure. Important word. A word that will continue, thank you. And you are again, Francis? Thank you. That word, big block letters, blinking. Disclosure. Other contexts where we hear about disclosure obligations?
Securities.
Publicly traded companies are required to disclose all sorts of things to the public, so that the markets reflect full knowledge. If they don't disclose to everybody, but disclose to some people, and those some people go ahead and buy and sell shares of the stock because they know something and others don't, what do we call that? Insider trading. And it's illegal. Why is it illegal? Because the Securities and Exchange Commission has the legal authority to make sure that the markets work properly, and the theory is the markets work most properly when everyone has complete access to information, or at least information that's likely to affect stock price. So when Steve Jobs decides to resign, right, he doesn't just tell a couple friends. They publish a press release. They publish the text of the letter. And you see that the stock market acts as the stock market acts. But they do it publicly because that's the requirement. Now, is there a requirement to publish a privacy policy? Generally speaking, U.S. law. I know we haven't taken the class yet. What do you think? Day one. Hour, minute 15, whatever it is there a law that says that websites must publish privacy policy? Anyone here run a website in your professional lives? There is one. There isn't. Nope. Certain contexts that we will talk about, there is a requirement. Generally not. You don't need, you federally, I should say. On a state-by-state basis, we're getting there. California essentially requires notice, but generally speaking, it doesn't. So why do it? Why? Well, here's the problem with the idea of protecting, meaning the company.
Yes.
Here's the problem with that. Where is the exposure? If it's not legally required, and they do it, how can it get them into trouble? What's the idea of disclosure? What's the concept? What is it supposed to do for the public? What? inform. And the underlying assumption is that information is, as opposed to misinformation, the information is valid, correct, accurate, complete. Where does the FTC have jurisdiction in a privacy policy? When the privacy policy is wrong. Not when the practices necessarily violate a law. But disclosure brings with it an obligation to tell the truth.
Sure.
Generally true. For a privacy policy, there's no. We'll get into context like financial, for financial or health or children. There are times and situations where.
And so those persons that should choose to have a privacy policy for disclosure, for some purpose other than the legal necessity, would then expose themselves.
That's
when
correct.
In fact they're attempting not to expose themselves.
Or they're attempting to do something else. You're not confused at all. You have absolutely understood this. Absolutely. So why is it? Oh, by the way, this idea that the privacy practices, so what's on you, what, you know, who sees what's on your wall, etc. Yeah, except that if they can get your profile, what's on your wall is almost irrelevant. This is mine. Okay? You can see, now I don't know if I could change these things, but there's a lot here that I wouldn't consider private information. It's not wall postings. But from the ads, from the events, my friends, you know, picture of me in high school, picture of you and my daughter, whatever, you learn a lot about me. There it is. I told you, it's my birthday, right? Works here, studied there. Speaking of studying there, again, what's in the news today? So we have two topics here. We have privacy and policies, and we have data breach. Did you know that 43,000 data names and social security numbers of people associated or those of 43,000 people associated with the Yale University were exposed on Google for a period of 10 months. Oops. The data belonged to students, faculty, staff, and alumni who were affiliated with the university in 1999. I hope that, because I was a graduate in 92. Oops. There was a server that was open. There was a file on it. You could search it with Google. Oops! That was a story broke last week. That's when I say these things are as current as they are. Every class we're going to have, there will be new stories. Why do they do this? Oh, so we're talking about... I got a little bit off just because... This stuff is really interesting, to me anyway. I hope it is to you. I think you will find that it was relevant, whether or not it was interesting. So we have a twin page. I would ask, parenthetically, and I'll post this, you get this. I maintain a list, which is, I've actually maintained for the last 10 years for all my classes, that I send out cyber law type stories of interest. So it asks that you please subscribe to Cyber Law Class. You just send an email to cyberlawclass-subscribe@yahoogroups.com. That's not an underscore, it's a dash, a little hyphen. cyberlawclass-subscribe@yahoogroups.com. And you will get, they're very, it's not all that frequent. I send stories. I also send jobs. So stay on the list after graduation. That's incorrect. Our final exam, I believe, is December 22nd. Which is a Thursday night from 6:30 to 9:30. That is true. back to bookkeeping, housekeeping. Here's what I'm going to ask you to do. This is not a memorization class, which is good because I'm all over the place. And because it's a constantly changing area. I'm going to be talking concepts. I'm going to be talking practical stuff, too. I'm going to be testing you. There's no midterm. The final exam will be a series of essay questions. I will give you probably 6 or 7. You get to choose, most likely 4. See how it works out. Either 3 or 4 broken out. Your favorite 3 or 4. Open materials. Open materials, with apologies to trees, means anything you can put on a piece of paper. Not electronic, because that's a little bit too ephemeral. And besides, if you take the exam on your computers, it's locked out anyway. Books, notes, materials, study guides, 73,000 social security numbers from Yale people printed out on a very big stack of paper. Whatever it is, it's not about memorization. I want to see how you think. I want to see you take the facts of maybe a hypothetical. Maybe it'll be a question based on something we talk about during the semester, and write an essay, or 3 or 4 essays, as the case may be. That's what we're going to do. So as you proceed in the class, think about that. Think about understanding that way, putting it into practice. If you don't get what I'm talking about, ask. Because I'm not going to say, you're not going to tell me what X case said, in part because one of the other reasons I didn't make you buy the case book is most of the cases aren't good law anymore. It changes so quickly. They're really useful to see the progression of the law, the courts, the thinking of these issues, but they're not applicable anymore. So that's, I'm not big on the case book per se. Think about it. That's how we're going to be doing this. I want you, ideally, to understand the subject, to be able to, in theory, counsel a client. Client says to you, should I publish a privacy policy? Well, the first thing you'll know is, well, let's see. By then, there may be a law. If there isn't, are you dealing with one of the contexts where you have to do something? If not, here's why it's a good idea, here's why it's not, here's what you have to do. If anyone wants to write a paper in lieu of final, I'm not a big fan of them, particularly since the exam is an essay exam anyway. If you're interested in the topic, want to write a paper for your advanced writing requirement, whatever it is, let me know. Or you can try to make a case. But I'm not really disposed to paper in lieu of final in this class. Okay, you know what? This is why I did all this work and it's killing me. Here's another reason why I'm teaching this class. Not only are these interesting ideas, I think, not only are they changing, but you know what? They're job creating. Privacy is probably among the fastest growing areas of legal employment. And since I'm assuming that most of you are here because you'd like to be attorneys and making at least some of a living that way, this is my sort of secret tip. People don't realize this. If you're really into residential real estate practice, I'm not sure there are going to be a whole lot of jobs. Maybe things will change, but you know what? Privacy law is evolving. There are more requirements, more understanding. So this is the Privacy Association, the International Association of Privacy Professionals, IAP, privacyassociation.org, jobs board, which is, many of these are not showing up anywhere else. And what do we have here? Oh, look. Assistant counsel for subscriber privacy and data security, Cablevision. Local employer, legal department, where are they hiring? Privacy. Now, you don't yet have 3 to 5 years of relevant experience. On the other hand, there are going to be more of these jobs.
And I'm hoping that having this course and the great grade you're all going to get on in the course, on your transcripts, is going to be a distinguishing factor. These, and even if you don't get a privacy job, you work for any business that has customer lists, employee lists, data about anything, they're dealing with this issue of privacy and data protection, data breach laws, and you'll know more than most people. That's why we do this.
Okay, back to this. I guess we should probably ask this question, though. I sort of started from the end and working my way to the beginning. So, what's privacy? I'm open to suggestions. Without looking at your Black's Law Dictionary, 12th edition, whatever it is now. I think, no, we're not 12th, are we? I had a 5th in law school. Whatever it is. Define privacy for me, please. Someone, Krista? You took a course in privacy in the digital age. Assuming you're here not just because it fit your schedule, what did you think it was about?
Protection of personal information of what's on the internet.
Okay. What is personal information?
What is personal information?
You just used a phrase, personal information. What does that mean to you?
Something that I don't want anyone else to know about me.
Okay. The crush you had in seventh grade. You may not care anymore. The crush you had last Tuesday. Whatever it is. Okay, so something you don't want anyone else to know. What about your name? I know your name. So clearly, whether or not you want me to know your name, you wrote it in nicely written big letters on this piece of paper. All right? So under your definition, names don't count. Right? You've said privacy is things you don't want other people to know. That is, I'm not criticizing your definition, that is a valid definition of privacy. But we were talking about privacy policies, right? Do privacy policies in your experience, I'm sure you read every single one to the word, do they deal with things like your secret habits and, you know, your crushes or whatever else you have in see where my mind goes. The things that you don't want anybody to know about? Is that what a privacy policy that you've read or looked at or thought about talks about?
No.
Okay, so we...
It's notifying you what could happen, I suppose, your information that you...
What information? So that's what we're getting to. Privacy is, one definition is, secret stuff. Another is... Well, the privacy policy more often talks about things like your name. So what do you think?
I think it's really just too broad of a term.
All right, I'm done.
You know, just think, like, I work, you know, I work at a broker-dealer firm, so, like, privacy for us, it's really like, you know, your bank account information, social security number, you know, your address, things like that. But when you look at it maybe in a telemarketing kind of way, like, you don't want, when you get, like, your credit cards in the mail, you know, do you not want to be on the, you know, do not call this? That is your name, your telephone number, your address. You know,
why is your... What's the difference between the first category and the second category?
It's really a level of the relationship that you have with the company or whomever that is issuing that privacy policy.
But wait, step back. You said at your broker-dealer firm, privacy means what?
Privacy is the personal information that you would disclose to your broker-dealer.
Okay, but... You just said the other example was the name. So does your broker-dealer not consider names private information?
It does consider names
okay.
private information.
So,
which is all kept in confidential in that firm.
All right. So we're getting to, from your employer's perspective, or maybe you are the employer, it's all your employees, I don't know. It is information about the person, right? About a customer. That's certainly a working definition. Okay. What about trades? Pattern of trades, holdings of your customers. Are those pieces of data private? Are they considered part of private information, privacy, stuff that is kept confidential?
Yeah, it is.
Okay, wait.
Yeah.
So, sold 150 shares of Apple Computer because panicked about Steve Jobs retiring. Who was that? Is that private? Does that identify the person? What does that tell us? Anyone here a journalist? Current life, past life? Took a class? Remember the 5 W's and an H? Anybody hear about this? Who, what, when, why, where, and how? Right. Which of those questions is answered by sold 150 shares of Apple? It's not who. It's not where. It's not when, necessarily. Today. How? By using the firm's services. Why? We have the why question. But what about the sold 150 shares? What? Behavior. What did that person do? What did some person do? Getting back to the definition that Christy gave us. Those private things. Things you don't want other people to know. Sometimes it's thoughts, feelings. A lot of times it's acts. Being watched. What was, some of you may be familiar with Big Brother, not the wildly successful reality series, but the notion, right? George Orwell's 1984. What was the frightening thing about Big Brother? He was watching you. It wasn't Big Brother knows who you are. He was watching you and therefore knew what? Well, yes, knew what? Knew what you were doing. So we're getting now, I think, to two really useful parallel concepts of privacy in this context. In the business world, that's really my focus here. Privacy in the digital age is rarely, you know, what your family member knows about you or knows you did. The law looks to, business world is really one aspect. You also have governmental, but organizational, outside the family. So one thing people think about the right to privacy is a freedom from having behavior monitored or having your behavior disclosed outside of those that do know it. It may be in person. I wish to be free from being followed around a store as if I were a thief. I wish to be free from being watched while I'm in the bathroom, the changing room, whatever. I wish to close my door so my boss doesn't notice that I'm on Facebook instead of doing my job, whatever it is. Freedom from monitoring over the internet or over a network, remotely, electronically, cameras, etc. The other side, the protection of personally identifiable information. That is another one of those phrases that what's going to come up. Disclosure is a big one. Personally identifiable information, PII. Pronounced personally identifiable information because to pronounce it any other way sounds silly. Any fact or facts that can identify a unique individual such as what? Social security number. What else? Address.
Bank accounts.
What?
Bank accounts.
Could be.
Birthday.
Well, hold off that one. Maybe. A whole lot of people born on a single date, no? Even
for a particular year, even a particular minute. Okay, what else? Name. Of course, it depends on your name, right? John Smith, not so much. Jonathan Ezor. I posted something on Twitter, and it was a photo, and it happened to have my address in it. And someone said, "Oh, you put your address." I said, "Look, my name is Jonathan Ezor. I am the only one, to my knowledge, in the whole country. I'm not hard to find. If I wished to hide my address, I failed. So I don't care, because I know it's out there." What about hair color? Is hair color personally identifiable information? No. Fine. Blonde. Look around. She's identified. You're unique. It didn't say where. Standing in the front of the room. In a vacuum, John Smith might not be personally identifiable information. A 9-digit number. On its own, 347-256-123. But if it happens to be a 9-digit number that turns out to be someone's social security number, it is.
There's another one of these things I have to look it up. So let's do this one.
AOL searcher number 4417749. Don't read down. Is AOL searcher 4417749 personally identifiable information in a vacuum? No, but in August of 2006, a division of AOL, which at the time was pretty darn important, AOL was the root onto the information superhighway for a whole lot of people 5 years ago. AOL released a database of searches. None of the searches, it was millions upon millions of searches, none of them had a name or an AOL user ID attached to them, but the searches were intact, the actual search terms. And each individual was identified by a number, so that you would be able to sort and see every single search that number 4417749 did. That was, I think, August 5th. Within two days. Two reporters from the New York Times took that huge database, sorted it, started looking to see if the searches that were done by a particular allegedly anonymized user were sufficiently unique so that, in fact, they could be used to identify the person. That search terms on their own, whether they could serve as personally identifiable information. And guess what? Thelma Arnold, a 62-year-old widow who lives in Lilburn, Georgia, seen here in the picture, was in AOL user number 4417749. How did they find out? Well, 4417749 conducted hundreds of searches, it tells us, over a 3-month period on topics ranging from numb fingers to 60 single men to dog that urinates on everything to landscapers in Lilburn, Georgia, several people with the last name Arnold,
and homes sold in Shadow Lake Subdivision, Gwinnett County, Georgia. Okay, so you take these together, and what you get are probably an older person, whether male or female, depending on orientation, 60 single men and numb fingers, suggests maybe an older person, not a quantity of 60 single men, but single men of the age of 60, I think is the implication. Dog that urinates on everything, probably a dog owner. Otherwise, you would say, you know, get dog off lawn. Landscapers in Lilburn, Georgia. Ooh, okay. Probably someone with land to be scaped in Lilburn, Georgia. Several people with the last name Arnold, whose last name is probably Arnold. Home shown, so, sold in Shadow Lake Subdivision, Gwinnett County, Georgia. Look at this. We have Thelma Arnold in a subdivision in Shadow Lake Subdivision in Lilburn, Georgia, which is in Gwinnett County. Gwinnett County, who has a dog and is 62. Search terms. That story, by the way, within a day after this, the database was pulled down, the researchers were fired, the CTO resigned. And if you want a copy of the database, I have it. It's still available. You can find it. I have it. Never looked in it, but I do keep it. Sort of a souvenir, talisman, of reminding me that the concept of personally identifiable information is not what the average person would think it is. So, consider, get back to this notion of privacy policies. And we'll revisit this question, but where, what did I tell you? Privacy policies, what the heck was that? I think I broke the school. Privacy policies, I should stand here, there's a mic. Expose the publisher when they are what? What? When is there liability in a privacy policy? As with any disclosure? When it is? Not true. Not necessarily lying, but inaccurate. So, consider. Consider the following language. We will not share your personal information with anyone. Comforting. You've probably seen that. Or some version of it. Yes? No? It's a lie. Excuse me, I shouldn't say that. It is a mistake. It is never, and I repeat, never true. How could I say such a thing? You see it in a website, right? Between you, your computer, and the owner of the website, you have your internet service provider. You possibly have a hosting company of the website. Transmission of a web page with your name on it, to you, goes through your internet service provider, they've just shared your personal information with a third party. It's not illegal. It's not even immoral or even fattening. It's exactly what you want, but it makes that statement inaccurate. If, Francis? Except if you, we, or...
He's charged with the obligation to deliver something.
Ah, but wait a minute. Wait a minute. Hold on a second. But the statement is, if it's a blunt statement, I'm not saying a privacy policy can't and shouldn't say, except to do what you would like us to do, or to run our business, we will not share with third parties.
We're not sharing that.
You're sure you are.
What does the word share mean?
It means to hand over. Would you share a secret?
Are you sharing a letter you give to the post office to deliver? Are you sharing that letter with that person?
Sure you are. You're sharing the address on it. You're not sharing the contents.
By the way,
precisely like
have you taken evidence?
No.
Have you heard of evidence? I didn't take it ever, so don't feel bad.
All right. You've heard of the attorney-client privilege, right?
Yes.
Okay. Are postcards between lawyers and clients covered by the attorney-client privilege?
Well, I don't think
they're not. Anyone have? Has anyone taken evidence yet or dealt with evidence?
Right.
That's your answer. It's exactly the same thing. The address, your letter carrier knows to whom you are writing.
What if you had the letter in the envelope and it wasn't postcard?
Then it's covered.
And my point exactly.
But I'm not talking about what's in the letter. I'm talking about personally identifiable information. We will not share, disclose your personally identifiable information to any third party, period. I cannot emphasize to you enough how many websites, well-meaning, not usually so sophisticated, but you'd be surprised, websites say that. It isn't ever, ever true. It's not what they mean to say is, we're not going to profit indirectly or be indiscreet with your personally identifiable information. But what they say, plain language, we won't share it with any third party. They will. What if AOL had said that? We will not share your personally identifiable information. We will not publish your personally identifiable information. We won't provide it to the New York Times or some such. Did they or did it, AOL? Did the researchers at AOL, would they have violated that with this? What do you think? Would they have thought so on day one? They put it out, all names anonymized. Take it away. 24601, not John Wilson. Or 1-441-7749, not Thelma Arnold. We took all the names out. We took the user IDs out. It's for research purposes. It was. It was a huge, wonderful body of real-world data to slice and dice. Day one, would the people at AOL have thought they had violated a promise not to publish personally identifiable information? I think they would have thought they were fine. Maybe even on day two, day three. The definition changed. The understanding changes. Blonde hair, personally identifiable in this room, yeah. So what represents, what makes information personally identifiable, it may be the obvious stuff. It may be the totally allegedly anonymous things, which taken as a whole or in the context, do in fact serve to identify someone. And when you're dealing with this from a legal perspective, as well as the disclosure and the you have issues of use. You have issues of misuse, and you have issues of disclosure. And all those concepts are addressed in the law and in practices. Of the two, particularly in the information age, the latter is much more likely to be subject to law than the former. That is, the monitoring side is addressed, but not as nearly as often as the idea of identity. Privacy policies don't so much, although we're getting there. We'll talk about that this semester. Deal with this idea of monitoring behavior nearly as much as you get issues of identity. And why does the digital age add significant weight? What changes with computers? What changes with the internet? Why now?
Access.
Access how?
Access to
my social security number?
I don't know, but those New York Times guys can figure it out.
Maybe.
Can we just revisit an Yale study?
Ah, but that, right. It's not simply punching a few keys, but it's much more likely now that 72,000 records might be accidentally made available. Anyone here ever worked in a restaurant? Okay. Restaurants keep receipts, right? The credit card slips. How much space do they take up? I mean, over time? A lot. Boxes. Work in an office with correspondence, paper correspondence, right? Records rooms, storage facilities. Consider 50 years ago, what would it take to steal 72,000 records from Yale University? A lot of trucks. What does it take now?
10 minutes.
Right? Phone. 16 gigabytes of storage. Think about 16 gigabytes. That's a lot. My first computer had 140 kilobytes on a big 5 1/4 inch magnetic spinning thing, one side. So this is more than, trying to do the math here, 1,000. Something like, around this, I'm probably dropping a zero, 100,000 times as much storage, from 140 kilobytes to 16 gigabytes, right? Because times 1,000 would be 160 kilobytes. Okay. Oh, we're meeting today. Buzzing and saying our class is starting. Thank you. This device is carrying 100,000 times. 100,000 times as much storage as my first computer's disk. I put a bunch of documents on one of those disks. I could play a game. How much can I store in here? So the computer part has added this idea of size is no longer an issue, quantity no longer an issue. I have at my home, as I'm sure you probably do, a high-speed internet connection. Oh boy. So I have a, what? Do the math. I think it's 40 kilobits per second, something like that. Megabits? 40 megabits per second from file, some number like that. It's an insane amount. 8 bits to a byte, so it's like, if it's 40 megabits, it's 5 megabytes per second into my house and out of my house again. So, what we have on the computer side, quantity no longer matters. We store libraries on stamps. What does the internet add? What do 40 megabits per second connections add to this notion? 50 years ago, assuming you had the trucks, where would you have to be to steal 70,000 records from Yale University? What? In New Haven, finding parking. Today, where do you have to be? My house, your house, Bryant Park, Starbucks, anywhere. Namibia, you know, the International Space Station, anywhere. Distance is irrelevant. So, quantity is irrelevant. Storage space is irrelevant. Distance is irrelevant. Okay, next question. Let's say you wanted to mess with all those records. 50 years ago, you wanted to change them, to erase them.
alter them in some way. What would you need? A whole lot of ink or a whole lot of erasers. What do you need now? Done. Delete. There's even a key. It's right there. It says delete, followed closely by end. And then you go home, and you're done. Integrity of records. The ability to change them. Next question. Let's say first person wanted to share a copy of the records with five of his closest friends 50 years ago. What would you need? How do you provide five copies of 70,000 records 50 years ago? 30 years ago? A whole lot of photocopiers, a whole lot of toner, a bunch of time, and five sets of trucks. How do you do it now? File sharing software, right? Think about the whole WikiLeaks thing. How did Anonymous, maybe Brad Manning, whatever, how were those records provided to the world? They were posted. Distance doesn't matter. Quantity, size. Right? Integrity is no longer a given. Medium no longer is given. Number of copies, irrelevant. Digital means perfect copy. Digital networks means perfect copies at a distance. Now we see why we need more laws, because the risks have gone so much higher. The ease of access, the ease of sharing, the ease of manipulating, and the damage that can be done, because we also live in a society where one can spend a whole lot of money without ever being face to face. It's a Wonderful Life. I love that film. George walks into Martini's bar or Gower's drugstore. Right? If it's Ernie or Bert, and yes, they are called Ernie and Bert, his two friends, go look it up, who walk in to Mr. Gower's drugstore and say, "Hey, Mr. Gower, here I am, George Bailey, can I have my prescription?" Gower's going to throw them out. Why? He knows who George Bailey is. He goes into Martini's bar. "Put it on my tab, I'm George Bailey." "No, you're Ernie." I never remember which one's the cab driver and which is the police guy. One of you is Ernie, right? You're Ernie the cop or Ernie the taxi driver. "You're not George Bailey, I'm not going to charge it to his tab." On the internet, everyone's George Bailey. The idea, once you disassociated personal knowledge of a person, once you have someone who has an account, so great. If your firm were not so good about protecting the confidentiality of customers' names and account numbers and access information, right? Then someone could log in, phone, whatever it is, and say, "I would like to change my account number 2467954. Here's my password," or whatever. "Please transfer all of my funds to this convenient Swiss establishment." Gone. Then the real customer comes up, "Ah, where's my money?" That's why. Because not only is the personally identifiable information that much more accessible, but it's that much more powerful. Identity theft is no longer catch me if you can. Right? You may have seen the movie, now there's going to be a musical. Right? It's a real guy. He wasn't even impersonating real people. The idea of an imposter. Mission Impossible, they made masks. No, identity theft is like those Citibank commercials where you see the little old lady with the trucker driver voice. Or people who use by the thousands. Funny thing. Remember when, a few months ago, the Sony PlayStation Network database was hacked, was broken into? funny thing is, somebody used my credit card to buy a lens from Amazon that week. Send it to California. Happily, Amazon noted that this credit card it had seen before was being used for rather expensive purchase, sent not to our typical address, and they called us. So we didn't have to spend the money. We didn't lose it. But this notion, they didn't steal my wallet. They broke into some database somewhere, got thousands upon thousands of credit cards, selected mine, used it on, thank God, on Amazon of all places, because Amazon had seen it before. They used it someplace we hadn't shopped. Who knows? Well, I do know, because it's a credit card, which means I have no liability anyway. Quick personal advice, don't use debit cards for anything. Because, at least not the ones that look like credit cards and have credit card numbers, because you have much less statutory protection for a debit card than you do for a credit card. And if the money is stolen, it's your money and not the issuing bank's money. It's one of those sort of minimize the damage of identity theft risk. Back to the question of why. So why is it that companies' websites have privacy policies, given the issues? Because people care. People worry about this stuff. Employees worry about it. Customers worry about it. If you are being asked for a lot of personally identifiable information, maybe even payment information, and it doesn't look like it's a reputable site, you won't necessarily, I hope you won't give it. One of the ways businesses demonstrate that they are allegedly reputable is they tell you what they're doing with your information. We have nothing to hide. We're going to use your information, hopefully it says, for the purposes that you want us to use it for, nothing else. You can read it. If we don't tell you, we don't know. Businesses, websites have privacy policies, even when they aren't legally obligated to do so, because otherwise customers may not be as comfortable with them. Similarly, employers can monitor what you do. To a certain extent, they may monitor what you do. But if they monitored what you do too closely, too often, and it's a decent enough labor market, what happens to employees? What happens? If you can get another job where you don't feel like you're being watched 100% of the time, right? That you don't have a supervisor who is constantly walking around to see what you're doing on your computer when you're supposed to be looking in class. Ah, I'm so proud. I'm looking to the side. I'm sure you guys are fine. Right? But if you've got a supervisor who's doing this all day, and you can get a job where you don't, you will. They'll be out of there. Yes?
What about those companies that have software on their computer?
What about it?
There you go.
If, now, so let's figure that out, right? There's plenty of ways, like I say, to monitor. Sometimes it's relevant. You've got employees who have access to financial information. You have employees who are working on sensitive information. Might be worth watching what they do. But you're in a newspaper. You're in a less sensitive business. And your employer, it turns out, is watching every keystroke, how will you feel? Make the case for me, employer, otherwise I'm not so comfortable here. You know, put a camera in the parking lot, great. Put a camera in the break room, I'm not so sure I'm happy about that. You know, have me sign into the sensitive room, great. Have me tracked when I go to the bathroom to see how often I'm going? Not so much. It's not just employers, by the way. Anybody here an EasyPass user? right? Has it occurred to you that it is absolutely a matter of about a second and a half for the EasyPass people, Thruway Authority, whomever, to issue automatic speeding tickets that are mathematically proven to be accurate, as long as you go between two toll plazas or two scanners in less time than the legal speed limit would allow you? Right? It is not a question. It's mathematically. I remember I took calculus in high school, and there was some movie. It was pre-Easy Pass, but it was some guy who went between two toll plazas, and he went 75 miles in an hour, and the speed limit max was 65. And there's some complicated area under the curve thing that proved, mathematically, he did exceed the speed limit at some point. They can. Do they? Why not? What? What do you think happens the day they turn that on? White plastic along every major highway, right? So on the one hand, you've got revenue from the tickets. On the other hand, why do they encourage EasyPass in the first place? To speed it up. Fewer employees, right? Better air quality around the plazas. I mean, all you have to do is see the cash lanes at any bridge. So we're trading a certain amount of privacy from monitoring for the convenience of going through quickly and not having to fish for money. But if they cross that line, what are we going to do? Right? It's not just, by the way, you make your choices. Where is it? It's in here somewhere. Have you seen these? You know what this is, right? Have you seen Easy Pay Express? I love this. This is the subway version of a metro, of an Easy Pass. It automatically charges my credit card. I don't have to worry about how much I have on my metro card. But wait a minute. What else does that enable? If you buy a metro card with cash, other than the cameras, right? They don't know who you are. If you buy a metro card with a credit card, even one, for at least the time you use that card, what can the MTA do? Not only track the card, they can always track the card. Track whose movements? Yours, identified at least. What do they know about you? Wait a minute. They can track the movements of whom? The person, they can track the movements of the person who used the card. That doesn't necessarily mean it is the owner of the card. Right? You ever get these red, right? They are doing red light tickets. Red light cameras everywhere. That's clearly revenue generated. To whom do they send the tickets? The owner, the registered owner of the car, whose burden then it might be to say, it wasn't I, it was stolen, here's a police report. Same is true for those toll plaza lanes. You blow through, there's just an article about how many people are just blowing through the toll plaza lanes without paying or having an easy pass. They take a picture of your license plate, they send to whom? To the registered owner of the car. So they cannot identify definitively the individual. A lot of these identifiers only go so far as the account holder. But if MetroCard, right, if the MTA, if I were someone who cared that they were watching me go back and forth between Forest Hills and Midtown Manhattan or whatever it is, I wouldn't do this because it gives them a trail. If ever I'm, you know, if ever one would have an affair and one were stupid enough to use one's credit card to pay the metro card, easy enough to track, right? We see that on Law and Order all the time. Easy Pass record show, went to Staten Island the night of the murder, that's where the murder was. Clearly was someone who was driving the car with the tag, dum dum, we know who it is. So, responsible use encouraged. Irresponsible use either overly aggressive or overly careless. Highlights the potential problems. And I'm going to give you a snapshot in a few minutes of 1 month a few years ago, how many data breaches there were. So we have the idea of collection of information, how the collector uses it, with whom the collector knowingly, intentionally shares it, and the responsibility of the collector for breaches, for not being appropriately careful. And there are a lot of legal issues. There are constitutional issues. Right? We have amendments, particularly the Fourth Amendment, although the First Amendment turns out to be relevant to privacy too. See how that is. Fourth Amendment, but to whom does the Fourth Amendment apply? The prohibition on unreasonable searches and seizures. Who's not allowed to do an unreasonable search and seizure? The government or governmental actors. So constitutional rights may not cover private institutions that do government. Statutory, you have laws. Gramm-Leach-Bliley law affects financial institutions. Children's Online Privacy Protection Act, which we'll talk about in a sec, about children. And you have regulations. So there are challenges within all of those in the United States, certainly abroad. Governmental practices, not just the constitutional side, but what is the highway, the throughway authority doing with the information? Businesses collecting and using data, particularly sensitive information. Reputational damages. Let's not lose track, let's lose sight of this. Yes, this is a law school, but again, I'm looking at this from a practical perspective. Lawyers are risk managers. That's what we do, whether we're litigators or transactional lawyers. What we are training you to do here in Touro College Jacob D. Fuchsberg Law Center, in addition to using the IRAC method, is to analyze risk. That's what we do. It's why we all end up being too risk averse. It's why lawyers are very cautious, because we're trained. Doctors become med students become hypochondriacs, and lawyers, law students, and then lawyers become very conservative. Maybe not politically so much, depends on who you are, but risk averse. We're not training you to be risk happy. You don't like risk. Good lawyer reviews risks, analyzes them, and advises the client how to reduce them or at least manage them. But legal risk is only one part of it. Reputational damage can be more expensive. And so we do our jobs as lawyers when we advise clients, don't do this or do that, because if you don't or you do, whatever it is, if you fail to follow my advice and X happens, you're going to be dealing with the customer service nightmare. It's going to cost you money. It's going to cost you sales. These aren't legal issues. These are business issues, but they're risks. And we as risk professionals do our jobs when we advise our clients about reputational damage too. One thing more, because I'm giving you a few, that you must keep in mind. We talked about what the privacy part means. What about the digital age? Well, I've discussed a little bit about how computers and networks like the internet have changed the practice, have changed the collection, the methods, and the realities of information use, collection, storage, and sharing. But there's another aspect that we cannot miss, forget, ignore. And that is that the internet is without borders. So much of law is geographically based. What's the first thing you did the first day of civil procedure, or whatever we're calling it this year? What? Jurisdiction. International shoe, right? And its progeny.
Jurisdiction. Remember that one? Didn't you do international shoe?
Yes, we did.
I don't even remember what the case is, but I know international shoe. Jurisdiction is about the where question. Which law applies? Which jurisdiction? Which locale's law applies to the facts, to the case, to the matter? Which court, location-wise, has the ability, has the right and the ability to act as an arbiter? It may not be nearby. What do we call it when the court that isn't close by is able to what?
Long-arm
jurisdiction. To get it and bring it back. Inherent in that is the idea of length, of distance, of physical space. Irrelevant here. The internet ignores borders, unless you've got a country where it controls the single pipe in and out. Iran, China. Absent those, in our country, you think our physical border is porous? Our electronic border makes our physical border look like a wall. You can send an email from that desk to that desk, and it may end up passing through Canada or Ireland, because that's the way the infrastructure works. That's the physics of it. That's the mechanics of it. It wasn't created with the law in mind. It was created so that if one line was cut, the message would still get through. But the result is, we've got to at least remember that international law, what country's laws? Pick one, pick all. May apply to what's going on here. Even if our client is local, its risk, its exposure could be international. And believe me, I've got stories. So, we'll go on. We'll go past this. Just the idea of, you know, data breaches, but we saw the Yale one, so we'll get past this too. This one was from 2 years ago. Two Russians and a Florida man were charged on Monday with hacking into Heartland Payment Systems, 7-Eleven, and the Hannaford Brothers supermarket chain, and stealing data related to more than 130 million, like Dr. Evil, million, credit and debit cards. And here's the international, right? So the indictment names 28-year-old Albert Gonzalez of Miami, who's already been charged with stealing data relating to 40 million credit cards from 8 major retailers, and two unnamed co-conspirators based in Russia. It's not that they were Russian in origin. No, they were in Russia at the time. Borders don't matter. So, real fast, because I want to get through to some of the other substance. Let me just give you a snapshot. May 2007, data breaches reported just that month. Someone put a keylogger on a treasurer's computer in Carson, California, tried to get the passwords that were typed in to get access to the city's bank account to try to steal $400,000. So there we had data breaches, not electronic sophisticated hackers, malicious hackers, but they stuck card readers on top of the card readers in New England Stop and Shops. People swiped their cards, punched in the numbers, but they weren't going just to the bank, they were also going to the thieves. Apple Computer, it was discovered that when they opened up iTunes to iTunes Plus or whatever it is, and they said, okay, you know, these are no longer protected by our digital rights management, but embedded within the digital file of the songs was customer information, account information, so that they could, in theory, track it. Or someone else could get the song and look at it. University of Colorado, 45,000 students' names and social security numbers. Northwestern University, someone stole a laptop from the financial aid office. Oops. With the social security numbers of students and alumni. So it's not just, again, it's not just the digital network, it's that a single laptop can have thousands upon the, yeah.
That happened when I was in Africa.
I'm sure that really made you feel so much better.
Yeah.
How about if you worked for the TSA? You know, Transportation Safety Administration. Hard drive that month lost with the names, social security numbers, dates of birth, and payroll and bank account information for 100,000 employees. Stony Brook, well, here's, it was in Nassau Community, May of 2007. Stony Brook had 89,853 current and former faculty records taken or released. Someone maliciously hacked it to the University of Missouri. The Illinois Department of Financial and Professional Regulation, oops, discovers potential compromise of names, social security numbers, and other personal data of an estimated 300,000 licensees and applicants. IBM, Alcatel-Lucent, very unsophisticated technically, you know, behind companies. Then there was ChoicePoint. ChoicePoint was the first big, well-known, well-reported mass data breach, and it wasn't a malicious hacking. ChoicePoint was fooled. ChoicePoint is one of these companies that collects consumer information and resells it. Huge profiles on all of us. What we buy, where we bought it, who we are, where we live. They don't collect it through a single website. They have sources and they collate this stuff. And if you were a large marketer and you were looking to sell your product or service to males between the ages of 35 and 45 who live in Nassau County, Long Island, who have three children and work in academia, you could go to ChoicePoint and buy those records. In theory, ChoicePoint sells to legitimate marketers. In practice, they slipped. And some illegitimate people fooled them into selling rather large databases of consumer records that would potentially lead to data theft, to identity theft. So in May of 2007, after this all happened and was publicized, ChoicePoint finally settled with 43 states and the District of Columbia over the breach. 163,000 consumer records in early 2005. They had already agreed to pay $10 million in civil penalties, $5 million in consumer redress, buying them credit reports, whatever it was. This settlement would limit what they sold. Oh, nice. You know, require written certification for access to consumer records and will conduct on-site visits to verify the legitimacy of some due audits and spend $500,000 on ID theft information campaigns because they were fooled. It's not a new problem. October of 2008, it's not an American problem only. In Germany, Deutsche Telekom announced in October of 2008 it had lost personal data for about 17 million T-Mobile Germany customers in the spring of 2006. 2.5 years later, that it became 30 million records were exposed in 2008. I suspect those numbers have gone up. And it's not just inconvenient. It's not even just financial. It can be life-threatening. Chinese dissidents were using Skype to communicate with each other. It's not very safe to be a dissident in a country like China. What they didn't realize was that Skype's partner in China was archiving politically sensitive text chat messages on unsecured servers. And there are now fears among dissidents in the country that the state has had access to them. You think it's embarrassing when one of your text messages gets disclosed to the wrong person. It can literally be fatal. And they did not realize that it was being collected. And so on and so on. So what kind of law do we have? Turns out we don't have as much as other places. Our approach generally is self-regulation. Asking, encouraging companies, collection, people, entities that are collecting to do the right thing. And not only to do the right thing, but to disclose what they are doing. That's where disclosure is relevant. If you are trusting, if you are looking for self-regulation, that is balanced with disclosure. And only where the context is sensitive, either because of from whom it's collected or what's collected, do we have laws. And I will quickly introduce you, and we will spend much more time in the semester looking at these in greater detail. The Children's Online Privacy Protection Act that was passed in 1998. The Gramm-Leach-Bliley Law, which is actually a banking deregulation law. It is what was talked about when the financial crisis happened a few years ago, when banks could then also become investment banks and could cross over. That was the Gramm-Leach-Bliley Law. But it came brought along with it financial privacy information. HIPAA, again, was not about privacy, but it turned out to be relevant. So now we're seeing more on the data protection side. Not so much the privacy policy, but in terms of data breach laws locally and nationally. What is COPPA? Brief introduction, again, we'll come back to this. COPPA is a federal law that addresses websites that are either targeting or appealing to children. Knowingly or unknowingly. What it says, now some of this is about issues of advertising disclosure. Here's what you need to know about COPPA. To the extent, this is the big one, to the extent that a website knowingly collects personal information from a user under the age of 13, it may only do so with verifiable parental consent. Not kids, ask your parents, but kids, we have to ask your parents. FTC, no surprise, has enforcement jurisdiction, and it can be very expensive. Now, when we say targeting or appealing to children, that's generally the case. This is the key fact. It may be a website about prostate health or about retirement savings, the Century Village informational website. If there is any sort of information collection that allows the site to pick up on the user's age, and that user reports that his or her age is under the age of 13, that data, those data may not be retained, may not be kept without verifiable parental consent. So even if the site is not a children's site, if it collects age or birth date with year, in any way, COPPA applies. And that is something that many, many businesses completely miss. So who gets caught by COPPA? Big brand names get caught by COPPA because they make good stories. Exhibit A, the Ohio Art Company, makers of Etch-A-Sketch, not your high-tech first business, right? We all know the Etch-A-Sketch, shake, 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 twist, left, right, up, down, right? So the site had Etchy's Birthday Club. Hey, kids, give us your birthday. Etchy will, I don't know what Etchy would do on their birthday automatically. Don't forget to ask your parents. No, April 2002. The FTC fined the Ohio Art Company $35,000 in one of the first major enforcement actions of COPPA. That was just the first. Next year, Mrs. Fields Cookies, same situation, a birthday club, $100,000, Hershey Foods, $85,000. These were not malicious, these were not evil, they just didn't ask first. Universal Music, owners of Little Romeo, who's I guess now Big Romeo, $400,000 in 2004. Zanga, $1 million in 2006, IMBY, $130,000, Sony, another $1 million, and just this month, the first mobile application company, what? You say that, but you're not their lawyer, right? Okay, here we go. Just this week, well, we see this was reported this week, W3 Innovations agreed to pay $50,000 to settle charges it had violated COPPA by collecting and disclosing the personally identifiable information from thousands of children under the age of 13 without parental consent. So these were apps like Emily's Girl World, Emily's Dress Up, Emily's Dress Up and Shop, Emily's Runway High Fashion. Clearly not targeted at boys, at least not most. So this was the first, So this continues. Graham Leach Bliley is about financial information. Less stringent. About advertising. Yes, account information does not get disclosed. But that you have an account can be. And customers have to be given annual notice and the ability to opt out. You get this every year from your credit card and your bank and everybody else. Here's what made Graham Leach Bliley interesting. Who was covered by it? Those involved in financial activities. Very broadly defined. What about tax lawyers? Real estate lawyers who were making securities lawyers, making investment advisors. On the pure face of this regulation, law firms were going to have to send out annual notices saying, "Dear client, the following is an explanation of how we share your personal information." We don't. But they would have had to send this letter every year. In fact, the American Bar Association had to sue to get a court to define this, to exempt attorneys, and CPAs have also been exempted from this requirement. But without it on the pure face, we'd be sending letters too. It's very strange. That may be true. The issue here was the question of disclosure, who had to disclose, not whose information. And I'm not discounting what you're saying. Again, we're going to come back to these. Just want to introduce some of the context. We've seen HIPAA, Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act. It was not about privacy, but they said, well, to make health insurance portable and to have accountability, we need digital records shared. If we have digital records, it opens up the potential for abuse, so we need to create these insanely complicated, huge pairs of rules for privacy and security relating to health information, not only for the providers, but for the companies that work with them, like IT firms, who are business associates. And with the High Tech Act, which is part of the stimulus package, those rules have gotten even further revised. How does this play out? Well, consider 2003, University of California, San Francisco Medical Center got a letter from a woman in Pakistan saying, "Pay me what your patient records are out in the open, so you better track that person and make him pay my dues." She was a subcontractor with their medical transcription service. They hadn't paid her $100. She had patient records from UCSF. She attached them to the email. So all this wonderful HIPAA compliance, you hand off to your business associate, they subcontract, the patient records end up in Pakistan, and it gets reported. But clearly UCSF must have learned its lesson. Oh, wait a minute. May of 2008, one of their fundraisers had access to patient records because they went and said, "Oh, we saved your life, come give us money." Those records were stored on an open server that was potentially accessible to the public. There was another story I found after that talking about UCSF's broad privacy education practices, you know, for its doctors, but this was 5 years later. It's too easy, even for responsible institutions. Once that information is digital, it really can be out there. And then we have this notion of health records. So I mentioned the Constitution. Again, this is just sort of the concepts of all of this. That comes up with the government. So we need to remember that there have to be government actors, how searches and seizures are defined, all these things we'll get into, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. There are also three major laws that we're going to be looking at: the Wiretap Act, the Pen Register Statute. This will be posted, and the Stored Communications Act, all part of the Electronic Communications Privacy. Privacy Act, which was one of the first major federal statutes about this stuff. Different parts, get into it. And internationally, I know I'm rushing through this, I want to be done by 10, and we have an entire semester. But these are the bullet points. Different countries, different rules. Europe has a very different conception of what responsible data practices are. Comes probably out of the history of Europe and what has been done and how knowing who people are and what they've done and what their background is has been abused by governments. So in Europe, European Union companies are subject to the Data Protection Directive, which sharply limits how they can collect information. They have to report it, what they may use it. It has a problem with transferring out to the United States. There's a safe harbor for that. We'll revisit this, but understand that domestic companies may still face EU risk because their data are going out and they have to come back. Other countries have major privacy laws, and you can violate it without realizing it, and then your client's executives go to another country, get arrested and convicted because something their company did violates local law. All right, we'll get into, when we get to consumer privacy, more looking at how the FTC has dealt with this, but with its very broad jurisdiction, some people don't feel that that's sufficient. States have their own laws. California, the reason we knew about Choice Point is because California residents were informed about the breach, and then they told their friends. There's also this formal requirement of a privacy policy in California. A lot of stuff. We will look at it in depth. Questions, thoughts, comments? Watch the TWEN page, sign up as soon as you can. I will be posting the syllabus, the readings, my responsibility. So if something is delayed, I'm not going to hold you to, oh, it's up on Wednesday, you have to have it by Thursday. It's not fair. I'm going to try to pace it out, give you time. I know you'd like to be able to read before the week of class. I'm doing my best. There's going to be a lot of primary source material, cases, articles. I want you to read them to understand what they're about. So rather than trusting a casebook author to give you the relevant stuff, and then you say, what the heck is going on here because they gave me this piece? I'm going to ask you to skim them to be able to generally brief the cases. I'm not going to hold you to every little fact. But I'd rather have you read them for content and understanding when necessary. Right? It's going to be fun. It's going to be evolving. I apologize in advance if it gets a little bit unusual, but I see this as a collaborative exercise, and whatever happens, I feel confident in guaranteeing you that this will be an immediately valuable, practical course that I hope all of you continue to take and that you tell your friends who are looking for an extra 2 credits. In any event, have fun. Have a good evening. And if you haven't signed up and intend to, please do.